From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Historian Jill Lepore begins her new book with a revealing observation. In 1787, the pages of American newspapers were filled with advertisements for the local apothecary, for codfish sales, for slave auctions, and also a copy of the newly penned Constitution of the nascent United States. Plus, in New York, Alexander Hamilton's Federalist No. 1. Well, that jumble of the quotidian, the moral atrocities, and the beacon of liberty, that jumble lies at the heart of the American story, one that Lepore says is a 500-year struggle between fact and fiction, enlightened ideals and hypocrisy. So these days, when we say these truths are self-evident, what do we really mean? This hour on Point, interrogating truth in American history with Jill Lepore. You can join us on air or online. Do you think America has lived up to its ideals? And in what way do we need to improve? What do we mean when we say these truths are self-evident? You can, of course, join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And Jill Lepore joins us now from New York. She's a professor of American history at Harvard University, a staff writer as well at The New Yorker magazine. Her new book is These Truths, A History of the United States, and we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Jill Lepore, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Meghna.
It is great to talk to you. I've been sort of like gobbling up your book.
We have 1 hour to cover all of American history.
All 500 years of it. So let's go.
We can do it.
Well, let me just start off with a really basic question. This is 700 plus pages, 500 years of history. What made you want to take this on?
You know, I guess partly I just really wish there were a book like this, just for teaching purposes, among other reasons, that, you know, and also watching my kids go through school and their AP US history classes, that I think that there's lots of great textbooks out there. They're written by teams of authors, but there really isn't a single volume sweeping account of American history with a narrative voice that I think has a propulsive force. So actually, honestly, it was as much as anything a dare. Like, I was asked by a publisher to do it. You know, like, sort of, this is like, can we get it, cover all of American history in 1 hour? I was like, could you cover all of American history? We're doing the pages of a single volume book and come under 1,000 pages.
Actually, you rose to a dare. I'm going to like dare you to jump across a canyon next.
I know. It's a bad, I'm a little embarrassed about that. But because I really did feel like there was a, I said, where on the bookshelf is this book? And I thought there should be one, because we have a very polarized present, but that rests on a polarized understanding of the past.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, like, I think a lot of people of goodwill would like to feel like we're doing our part to repair the breach. And for me, as a historian, that kind of begins with understanding the past in a way that we can all find our ancestors in that story and all wrestle with its, you know, its beauty and its agony. So that's what I just feel like, well, this will feel, I feel like I'm doing my part.
Yeah.
Give it a try.
Well, so, I mean, and the central, the line, one of the threads that you try to draw through this 500-year history of what's happened on the North American continent is this question of truth and how Americans have perceived what truth is, how its centrality to the American story, our struggles with it. What I read is originally you wanted to sort of stop your book with the presidency of Barack Obama, but notions of truth came front and center once again in 2016, so you kept writing.
Yeah, or I mean, honestly, I feel like I had to keep writing because the election of 2016 was an important realigning election. I think people who went out and voted for Trump felt that they were part of a revolution, and it just seemed like a disservice to that political movement to not cover it. Like, it would be kind of an act of professional negligence. But the theme of truth is something that I know it's the front of mind, as the kind of popular saying goes at the moment, but I've been teaching a course for a number of years at the law school on the history of evidence that looks at how our ideas about what counts as evidence and how we evaluate evidence have changed since the 13th century, looking at the law, history, science, and journalism. So that's actually what I've been studying the last few years, is because I, for a while, have been kind of paying attention to this changing, shifting sands around how we know what we know, mm-hmm. and can we agree that we have a common body of knowledge on which to argue about the future of the country or the future of the planet. And so that's just a thing that I've been really actively teaching and thinking about. And it seemed like the right theme for a unifying theme for kind of a sweeping history, because the country really is founded on, you know, the Declaration of Independence. We forget when Jefferson writes, "Let facts be submitted to a candid world." Like, it is an act of offering a claim, right?
Right.
This is a moment in time when this country has been done wrong, that these people have been done wrong, and therefore have the right to declare themselves independent of this other country. And we're going to present these facts to you, and you can make your own decision, weighing the facts.
So let's explore that a little bit more, because right at the get-go of the book, you talk about how that very particular notion of facts and truth lies at the heart of the sort of the 18th century founding of the country, right? You quoted Jefferson. You also talk about Madison and the fact that he for him, evidence was everything. And then you also point out that it was Benjamin Franklin who edited Jefferson and turned what Jefferson had originally considered as sacred truths into self-evident ones. Now, why is that particular edit by Franklin so important?
Yeah, it really looms large. Franklin is so interesting. I mean, he's just endlessly interesting. But what I think he's trying to do there is these guys are Enlightenment thinkers, and they're philosophers, and they're students of history. So they're going to be drawn to the language of empiricism, right? Proof, facts, truth. And Jefferson is throughout that document. But there's also an appeal to the sacred. We are endowed by our creator, right? But for Franklin, I mean, we're just trying to leap into his imagination here. For Franklin to call the truths on which the republic is founded, that is, you know, political equality, the sovereignty of the people, the consent of the governed, that these are sacred truths, then they're God-given and divine, and they can't be questioned. So to say that they're self-evident doesn't quite mean exactly what we mean by it now. It means sort of that they're evident upon inspection and study, like you as a self can investigate those truths and decide that they are true. But they are nevertheless within the realm of disputation, as opposed to divine truths, which you're really not supposed to question. They're God-given. Like, only God knows these things, and we have to accept that they're sort of mysterious. And that transformation really is important. I mean, as I also say, though, this is actually, it's kind of sounds better. Like, Franklin is a very good editor. Like, he writes with a little bit more force in some ways. But there is that tension there, and there's always that tension there, and it plays out again and again and again, and it plays out in our world,
yeah,
of course, every day.
Well, so I'm going to come back to this particular, dichotomy of conceptions of truth a couple of times this hour. But let's actually just jump way, way, way back to 1492, because, you know, in terms of the contradictory notions or uses of quote-unquote truth in American history, you point out early on in the book that, you know, when Columbus landed in the Caribbean, he right from the get-go, very forcefully enforced or threw his version of truth onto what he found.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, just it's kind of controversial to begin a book of American history in 1492 and 2018, where, you know, people no longer celebrate Columbus Day and have replaced it with Indigenous Peoples Day. I mean, we have a lot of awareness about the atrocities that followed in the wake of that, you know, that landing. But what I wanted to do was to call attention to partly the asymmetry of the historical record. Like, Columbus keeps a logbook. He writes down what he sees. And in the historical record, no one can gainsay that. Like, no one has evidence that is of that evidentiary status. That is to say, there's not some competing chronicle of what happened that day. And
yeah, because the chronicle that would be there was carried in the oral history of the people that were wiped out.
Right, who were wiped out. He also uses that technology of writing something down on a piece of paper to take possession. Like, he has these guys on his ship witness him say, right on I, seeing that these people have no culture, no language, no government, and are heathen, I take their land. I mean, there's this incredible, that is, he decides who they are and what their political status is and their legal status. And he sort of erases them. And we all descend from that act. I mean, that act of the relationship between a technology of communication and the political order, we still struggle with that, right? That is the primal scene of our Facebook disaster in some sort of way. I mean, I don't mean to force that, but just to say it's really worth thinking through. And that's the point of the book, right? I take this long view and like think, okay, we really care about how technology and politics relate to one another.
Yeah. Well, can I just jump in here?
We
could spend the hour just talking about this one thing about technology, politics, and truth. But it's so many questions from here. I mean, you point out that, yes, because Columbus, unlike, you know, Marco Polo, contemporaneously wrote down, you know, his assertions about what he found and sent it back to Spain. And then at the same time, there was the printing press, right? So the literal truth, quote unquote, literal truth of what Columbus was asserting spread quite rapidly. And then the various technological revolutions that we've had since then, it really gives power in terms of the determining what the truth is to people who are in ownership of that technology. But I'd say the difference we have right now is that it's the very technology, you know, to what you were getting at, the very technology we have with social media that's actually completely exploded our trust in the truth.
Yeah, although, I mean, I don't want to linger on the 15th century. We have a lot of eras to cover. But what for me is really powerful there is the way people answer back to Columbus, even not in writing. They ask, by what right do you take our land? And that, we are descended from that question.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to a little bit from the musical Hamilton, because we're going to talk about Alexander Hamilton when we come back from the break. I am speaking with Jill Lepore. She's a professor of American history at Harvard University and author of the new book, These Truths, A History of the United States. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Scratch that. This is not a moment. It's the movement where all the hungriest brothers with something to prove went. Foes oppose us. We take an honest stand. We roll like Moses, claiming our promised land. And if we win our independence, is that a guarantee of freedom for our descendants? Or will the blood we shed begin an endless cycle of vengeance and death with no defendants? I know the action in the street is exciting, but Jesus, between all the bleeding and fighting, I've been reading and writing. We need to handle our financial situation. Are we a nation of states? What's the state of our nation? I'm past patiently waiting. I'm passionately smashing every expectation. Every action's an act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties and sorrow. For the first time, I'm thinking past tomorrow. And I am not pulling away my shot.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking with Jill Lepore this hour. She's a professor of American history at Harvard University and author of the sweeping new book, These Truths, A History of the United States. Now, Professor Lepore, before the break there, you said you didn't want to spend the whole hour on 1492 and point taken. But in my defense, I just want to say you need to stop writing books and that have so many interesting things on literally every page, okay? But I take your point and let's move ahead to the 18th century, because really at the center, there's this rhetorical question that you ask, or actually not even rhetorical, a straight question that you ask that animates the entire book. And it's one that you ask through the figure of Alexander Hamilton and Federalist Paper Number 1. Tell us what it is that he wrote and why you think it's so important for us to focus on that.
Yeah. So in Federalist 1, you know, this is written 1787 after the Constitutional Convention. The federal people who support the Constitution are trying to convince Americans to support it. It's a very close call, right, to ratify the Constitution. And Hamilton's big argument in the first of these essays, Federalist 1, is, look, this is a whole new thing in the history of the world. People have erected their own system of government, and you get to decide, are you going to, you know, support it or not? Is it going to become our system or not? But think about this. This falls to you, the American people. It is up to you to decide in the future of all humanity. Are men fated to live and die under governments that are ruled by accident and force, like demagoguery, passions, violence? Or is it possible for us to be the first people in the history of the world to erect a government that is ruled not by accident and force, but by reason and choice? Mm-hmm. That is the question we put to you. And this is, you know, it's kind of hard sell of the Constitution. And I love that essay, but when I teach it, I always make these kind of facsimile reprints of the newspaper in which it first appeared in New York. And because in that same issue, their advertisements for slaves. Right. There's, you know, one really powerful one for a woman still nursing her 6-month-old baby boy. You know, she's good at housework or something. It says like that. And it's like, that is not someone who is given a choice to vote on this system of government and has no ability to choose a system of government where it would be ruled by reason and choice. This is accident and force. This is force. So, you know, there's something so stirring about that Hamilton essay. And then there's, I think you got to kind of keep your feet back on the ground to think about what does that mean? Who is he talking to? And that's what we still have that question.
Yeah. I mean, so the context of that is so important because usually when we study Hamilton, Jefferson, Franklin and the like, they are virtually in isolation, I think. I mean, except for true students of history who read all of these books. But doesn't that exactly, again, sort of force us to reckon with the irony of this choice that Hamilton said some people had, that from the start of America's, the United States' formal history as a cohesive nation, that choice obviously was not one that everybody could take. I mean, it was basically just for land-owning white men.
Yeah, and so that's what's so fascinating about the story is even the fact that choice exists, we failed to see, and I think Hamilton himself failed to see, how much that choice was made possible by the protests of people who were enslaved. Like, so much of what happens in the 18th century and even in the 17th century, kind of pushing political philosophers to think hard about the consent of the governed, actually comes from slave rebellions and comes from runaway slaves. Every person who ran away from a condition of chattel bondage was saying, you have no right to my life. You just don't. I have a natural right to my life and my liberty. That is what every runaway said. So we don't have their speeches and we don't have their essays, but Hamilton could not have written that essay without their protests. And it's not to say that that's inspiring about Hamilton, but it is to say, it's not like people then after the fact begin saying, hey, maybe we should end slavery. That's where that essay comes from.
Huh. So tell us more about that, though, because you write in the book about, slave rebellions and fear of slave rebellions and how there were two cases in New York that really drew a sharp line between the forms of liberty that America would tolerate in the 18th century.
Yeah, you know, sometimes today people will say, like, have we ever been so polarized in American history? And I always say, like, well, who's we? Like, when there was slavery, as long as you understand people who are enslaved as part of a political community, they are a faction that is quite polarized from everyone else politically. Like, we have been far more polarized in American history. And in fact, how we think about partisanship, in my view, as a historian, comes from the tolerance for political difference among people who are not enslaved. So in New York, in 1741, 1 in 5 New Yorkers was a slave. There's an alleged slave rebellion. There was a bunch of fires, and the white people in power believed that these were set by slaves who were trying to burn the city down. And they were burned at the stake. It's actually a much more significant event in American history than the Salem witchcraft trials in 1692. But how I see that event is that what also was happening in New York in the 1730s and 1740s is this, the establishment of the freedom of the press and this John Peter Zenger trial in 1735, which is where American colonists first begin asserting the claim that it is possible to be a faction opposed to the government and still be loyal to the government. This isn't realized for several decades after that, the notion of kind of a party system, that before then parties were always bad. Mm-hmm. But the dynamic that I see in American history is often that what can be tolerated involving political pluralism is always inflected by the realities of slavery and segregation.
Right. So, I mean, just to draw a line under this, in the Zenger trial, he was found not guilty of rising up against the then governor of New York, the colonial governor of New York, right?
Right, right. Okay. By printing essays critical of the government.
Right.
And offering and suggesting that someone else should be governor, which allegedly is what the slaves did too. They wanted to make a guy named Caesar, an enslaved man, the governor. And that, you know, they get burned at the stake. And obviously, I mean, it's not that the outcome is surprising. It's that the point, how we teach American history tends to be segregated. Like, we have the history of politics on one side and the history of slavery or Jim Crow and civil rights on the other. But they're always in conversation with one another.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Jill Lepore. She's a historian and author of the new book, These Truths, A History of the United States. Professor Lepore, if I can, I just want to get some calls in here. Evan is calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Evan.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I want to say this book sounds fascinating, and I'm definitely going to check it out. And I wanted to comment and say that, you know, I don't think, you know, America really lives up to the ideals that we're all raised to believe America stands for. And if it's funny how, like, the flag protest, for instance, if you're a person of color, you understand the protest. And if you're, you know, a white person especially, you seem to just want to hold these ideals up as if they're truths. And when we teach history, we don't, you know, we don't teach, you know, that, like, the conquest of the West was a mass slaughter of the native peoples. And the fact that half the country genuinely believes that the Civil War was not fought over slavery, you know, these things resonate to today. And it really, I think, stokes the fires of this partisan divide that we have.
Evan, thank you so much for your call. Jill Lepore, do you have a thought to share with us?
Yeah, Evan, thanks for that. And I think you say so many interesting things, but I think then you exactly as you suggest, you have these two incompatible accounts of the country. Like, on the one hand, there's this sort of, like, American greatness story, and the other hand, there's this sort of the American atrocity story. And what I'm trying to do here is put those two stories within the covers of the same book, because they actually have always contributed to one another, and they both need to be taken seriously. So some of the most beautiful, I think, dissents against the American greatness story. Think of Frederick Douglass's 1852 speech, "What to the Negro is the 4th of July," and what she says, like, look, how can you ask people who are enslaved to celebrate your great day of freedom? Like, this is a nation of hypocrites. But Douglass is also completely committed to the idea of cherishing the Declaration of Independence and taking it to use it as an argument for emancipation. Like, that's the sort of beauty of how Douglass works rhetorically. Or if you think about, in 1987, Thurgood Marshall, was the bicentennial of the Constitution. And all these people, sort of the age of originalism, and all these people, like, celebrating kneeling before the shrine of the Constitution. And Thurgood Marshall said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to kneel before the shrine of the Constitution. This is a Constitution that legalized and sanctioned slavery and extended it for decades. And what I will celebrate are the 200 years of progress towards making that Constitution realize its promise. It's not like he's rejecting the Constitution. He's actually trying to find a way to hold on to the beauty within the tragedy. Mm.
You know, Jill Lepore, we've got a lot of folks on Twitter asking us, how is your book different from Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States?
So my book is really different from Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. I think Zinn, you know, was a lovely man, but that book is widely assigned still, I think, in a lot of high schools. And I think that's unfortunate. It's a very old book. It was written on the occasion, really, of the American Bicentennial in the early 1970s. I think it was published in 1975. It's been updated many times. Academic historians are very critical of the history in that book. I think it's a lot of it is fairly tendentious. I don't think that Zinn necessarily expected it to become some authoritative account. I think it was an intervention at a particular moment in time, and it served a really important purpose. I was really trying to sort of set aside from the left that ideologically driven history that Zinn's People's History represents, and from the right, the ideologically driven hyper-conservative history that sees, you know, that refuses to engage with slavery, refuses to engage with Jim Crow, refuses to engage with women in any way. I was trying to do something different from either of those projects.
Okay. Let's go to Harris, who's calling from Chestertown, Maryland. You're on the air, Harris.
Hello. I'm glad to have this book coming out. I'm really looking forward to it. As a civics teacher, you're trying to find as many nuggets as you can to hold students' attention. And in the course of going back and looking at these different moments, the eloquence and the writing of the founders and the people at that time are really great. But it also, you're consistently reminded how silly we are when we keep thinking we've mastered something and have ignored so many other pieces. The lessons that people were able to reflect upon, and the one I'm getting to is Washington's farewell address, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, Hamilton may have some fingerprints on, where Washington recounts his experience as president and leaves that as his, you know, to the people is this is what I think is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And he has a section towards the last part that's just genius, because he talks about if we indulge partisanship too much, it's simply going to bring out the absolute worst in our natures. and he does a great job, or Hamilton does, of listing what those are. But among them, which is timely, he says that foreign powers will find it facilitated access through the channels of party passion. You know, this, and where I remind students is this is just simply human nature, that we keep getting technology. It doesn't change our nature one little bit. We're as messed up as we've been. We keep trying, thank goodness. But Washington's lesson is this prescient this long time later. So, again, if the book sounds right, like it's in the same vein, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, Harris, thank you for your call. Jill Lepore, what do you want to say?
Yeah, so I think that is so interesting. I think of the book as, and I say, you know, I want this to work as an old-fashioned civics book. I think civics is really important, and I'm delighted to hear from Harris committed to doing that work. It's unfortunate that we, I think, don't know as much about the history and origins of our democratic institutions as we should. I always find when I like write pieces for The New Yorker that are about some institution that all the mail I get is from high school students saying, oh my gosh, I didn't know the party system wasn't in the Constitution. I didn't know that Washington was opposed to parties, that everybody in the 18th century thought parties were bad. So there's something to be contributed there, but I think there's also the, it's important to celebrate these gains that are also sometimes setbacks. So, for instance, the secret ballot. Most Americans think that we've always voted secretly, that that's some fundamental idea that our votes must be kept secret. That's not the case at all. Americans always voted publicly. It was considered dishonorable to try to hide how you were voting. You voted in a public square. It's completely obvious how everybody was voting. The secret ballot is a reform that people began campaigning for in the 1850s and 1860s. It's not adopted until the 1880s. And in many ways, it's a big Democratic advance because people are getting beat up at the polls because, you know, the Democratic Party will send thugs to beat up the Republican voter so they can't vote because everybody knows who everybody is because you're carrying this colored ticket, for the color of your ballot. So it seems like a big reform, make for better government. People can vote secretly, so no one's going to get hurt, and you have the integrity of your vote. But really, the reason that the secret ballot passed in most states as a reform was it was a way to disenfranchise newly enfranchised black men during Reconstruction, because it could work like a literacy test. So this thing that's both in advance is actually also a setback. And that, I think, is a part of the civics education that is important to think through, because it doesn't relieve us the responsibility of thinking about what many things in our world that we think are advances that are also clearly setbacks, but it helps us to focus on how that works.
Yeah. You know, I want to just jump around a little bit, jump forward, if we could, in history, and play a little bit of tape from 1952, okay? So we're moving forward here, marching forward through time. This is a presidential ad campaign. It's a TV spot called Eisenhower Answers America, in which a young African-American man speaks with then-general and Republican presidential candidate Dwight Eisenhower about the issues of the day.
General, the Democrats are telling me I never had it so good.
Can that be true when America is billions in debt, when prices have doubled, when taxes break our backs? And we are still fighting in Korea is tragic, and it's time for a change.
Now, Jill Lepore, I wanted to play that because even though we just skipped about 100 years of history, 1952 was the first year that ads were used in a presidential campaign, right? And it gets back to this question of
ads,
truth.
Television ads.
Yeah, so it gets back to this question of, like, you know, our shaping of the truth.
Yeah, so just to fill in the missing 100 years, I mean, think about the just quickly. Think about the problem. So first you have, okay, we're going to have these reasoned property gentlemen who are educated, and they're going to look at the evidence and cast good votes because they can discern what's true because they're very well educated. Then you enfranchise all poor white men. Then you enfranchise black men. Then you enfranchise all women. So by the time we get to 1952, we have mass democracy, right? Everybody can vote, or theoretically. Under Jim Crow, black men and women in the South are not able to vote. But we have the idea of mass democracy. So then how, not everybody is equally educated. How are people going to make their decision? What happens is that the political consulting industry emerges already by the 1930s and then really goes to town in the 1950s with television advertising to work through suasion, right? So then less and less are we asked to reason, to examine the evidence and reason about our voting. We're asked to allow ourselves to be persuaded. Voting becomes more of a consumer preference. And that's actually, I think, pretty pernicious. It's a different perniciousness than our contemporary moment. And what I love about these elections in the 50s is you see people trying to question it. So Adlai Stevenson runs against Eisenhower and keeps trying to say, TV is a sham. Don't believe what you hear on TV.
Wow. Well, He didn't get very far on that, did he? Jill Lepore is joining us this hour. She's professor of American history at Harvard University and author of These Truths, A History of the United States. We're really trying to explore truth and its role, or conceptions of truth and its role in American history and where we find ourselves today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking with Jill Lepore. She's author of the new book, These Truths, A History of the United States. Professor Lepore, I want to spend this last portion of this conversation sort of talking about where we are now. And I have to say, this morning when I was reading the end of the book where you talk about the 2016 election and fake news and Russian meddling and the aftermath of that, it was actually a little strange experience to read that. because the whole rest of the book, I mean, you're talking about history that we haven't personally in our, you know, own actual physical lives lived. So we have the comfort of the distance of time. But to hear that same historian's voice and tone and analysis with news and events that we're still living with, it was a little disconcerting.
Yeah, it was really hard to write. So most U.S. history books say that are used in schools stop, the ones that are being published now stop around 1989 or 1991 with the end of the Cold War. I don't know about you, when I was growing up, like, our books went through Vietnam, but we stopped at the end of World War II. Yeah, it's you, as most textbooks are, end quite comfortably in the past, because historians don't like to write about the recent past. We don't know it well enough. Especially in our partisan times, it's hard to teach the recent past because it feels like you could get into kind of partisan waters and lose your footing a little bit. I decided I really needed to go up to the election of 2016, which is uncomfortably recent for me too. And that last chapter was really hard to write because it starts, you know, with the devastation of 9/11.
Yeah.
And it ends with the election of Donald Trump, which, you know, triumph for many people, a tragedy for many others. And to try to write about that era, you know, as honestly as I could, while also trying to get some vantage on it. I mean, it's so recent.
Right.
Well, and so, even, you know, when I was finishing it, I remember I was like writing something about the Cambridge Analytica stuff, like, and how Facebook had played a role. And I sent in the manuscript and I said, and Facebook revealed that 50 million users' data had been, you know, given to Cambridge Analytica. And then like the page proofs came back and I had to say, Facebook reveals that 87 million users' data, you know, and then the final proof can Facebook reels that they have no idea how many users' data has, like, just everything was changing as I was trying to write.
Well, you know, so with all due respect, when I read the end of the book, I felt like it had the tone of a historian from the future looking back at our current present that we're living in now. And it actually, what it made me think of was something that you do raise in the book, that it's the problem or challenge with writing these histories to begin with. Because, you know, because we're living this history right now, I was thinking to myself, well, this is an oversimplification. This isn't the whole story. This isn't the entire truth. I mean, as a historian, how do you grapple with that for any period in U.S. history that you're writing about?
Yeah, and that gets to one reason why such books don't exist, right? That used to be the case, that every American historian of a certain kind of ambition had got to this point, maybe the age I am, and wrote a sweeping account of the history of the United States. Like Woodrow Wilson did that. Major historians, Samuel Eliot Morrison, I mean, Bernard Bailyn, like people just would do, this is the thing you would do at a certain point in your career. And then in the 1960s, historians stopped doing that because the country became very divided. Its understanding of its past became quite splintered. all this incredibly rich explosion of research into groups that had been left out of the story of American history, women, sort of the rise of ethnic studies and black studies, sort of African-American history, LGBTQ studies. Then it seemed like there's just kind of all these different competing groups. Then there's a kind of conservative version of the American story. Then there's a liberal version. And so people just stopped trying to write this kind of a book because they felt like you couldn't do it. You just couldn't be done in this political environment. And I can see, you know, just as you suggest, there are all kinds of challenges to doing it. But I think the cost of not trying is greater.
Yeah.
Honestly, because we just don't have any notion of a shared past. We just don't have anyone asking, you know, to think about what does it mean to include all of the American people in the story of the American past. There's going to be a lot of loss and a lot left out.
But to try to make sense for a reader. You don't think we have anyone asking that? I would think that we have lots of politicians on both sides of the aisle who are saying exactly that we all have a shared past. Here's my version of what that shared past is, like it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that's what the Tea Party movement was, right? The Tea Party movement was a rejection of Obama's version of the past. Obama's version of the past quite consistent with Frederick Douglass and Thurgood Marshall's understanding of the complexities of realizing the promise of the Constitution. The Tea Party movement was about let's party like it's 1773. Like, let's go back to before all these challenges to our constitutional order. So that's part of the battle. That's part of the struggle. I mean, I get it. It is really difficult to try to do, to try to bring those two sides together. But one of the things I was really happy in working on the book was that I changed my mind about a lot of things when I was doing the research.
Uh-huh.
I tried to be really open to what are the competing versions of how do people understand the importance of, say, fundamentalism or evangelical revival or the conservative movement. And I also made a big priority of remedying deficiencies that nobody on either side of the political aisle has managed to remedy, which is people just don't write about the important role played by women in American political history. Women are kind of like they're just seeking women's rights, and they pop up occasionally and do a little kind of curtsy and then leave the stage. And that's a part of our political history that we have to incorporate into the larger sweeping narrative of the nation's past.
Well, since a minute ago you mentioned President Obama and his notion of how to contend with American history, we have a little bit of tape here. This is Obama speaking at Rutgers University commencement in 2016 about America's struggle with its own past.
America's progress has never been smooth or steady. Progress doesn't travel in a straight line. It zigs and zags, in fits and starts. Progress in America has been hard and contentious and sometimes bloody. It remains uneven. And at times, for every two steps forward, it feels like we take one step back.
President Barack Obama in 2016. Jill Lepore, the reason why I wanted to play that for you is my question is, would Alexander Hamilton actually disagree with Barack Obama? Because as we talked about at the beginning of the show, Hamilton in the 1780s was saying the United States has a choice. It has a choice between reason and evidence and steady progress versus chaos here. And Obama is actually saying part of American history is that zigzagging chaos. I mean, so would Hamilton disagree?
So what Hamilton and Obama share is a particular notion of progress, which is moral progress, right? It's a scientific and empirically minded progress, but it is absolutely a moral notion of progress. That progress is when we all do better together, right? To undertake a change is to consider how will this make our commonwealth better. That was challenged in the 19th century by technological utopianism, which kind of supplanted that moral idea of progress with technological progress, that as long as it's better, faster, costs less, that's better. It's not a kind of community or commonweal notion of progress, which by the 20th century was replaced with the idea that progress is prosperity. So long as we have economic growth, right? Like even the language changes. It's all about economic growth by the time you get to the 20th century. So the 18th century notion of moral progress is replaced by progress as economic growth. Obama's trying to reclaim that 18th century idea against I think, a very radical rejection of the idea of moral progress, which is our current rhetoric of technological disruptive innovation, right?
Yeah.
Disruptive innovation is progress without any morality at all. It's like we don't care what is going to happen when we invent this new thing. We are just trying to make money. We're just actually trying to put big businesses out of business and make a lot of money doing some groovy, cool thing that we can get venture capital for. That it's actually that the piece of the last, you know, 16, 20 years of American history that I find really the most troubling, because it's so deeply a rejection of the idea on which the nation was founded.
Well, let's go to Phyllis, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Phyllis, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I taught English humanities in Cambridge for almost 30 years, and I was well into my teaching career before I ever heard of anything like the Trail of Tears or Japanese internment. And I was very touched by Jill's recording of the fact that Columbus wrote the record that he did of his experience and in the process, of course, basically eliminated the culture of all of the people that he was running into. So I'm painfully aware that history, as we used to study it, was always based on who wrote the books. And for a very long time, the books were being written by white men. Now, people are even giving up books, and they're focusing on sending their students to Google, to Wikipedia, to anything on the web. And who knows who's writing all of that? So I'm left saying, how can we possibly understand what truth is, given the complexity of information that we have access to right now?
Well, Phyllis, thank you for your call. And Jill Lepore, let me just sort of dovetail onto what Phyllis is saying, because I was wondering about this when I was reading your book as well. That so we have a world now where we, because of the internet, we can effortlessly construct our own realities, our own little echo chambers around us. But I do wonder, in looking at the sweep of U.S. history that you write about, aside from the speed with we can do this, how different is it from Columbus constructing his own reality about what he found in the Caribbean when he landed in 1492? I mean, you know, was anything ever truly self-evident?
No, and nor was what Columbus did. I mean, the point of Columbus, he didn't really win that fight, right? In the end, people challenged what he believed, and so I don't mean to hold that up as, you know, Columbus's great triumph over the indigenous peoples of the Americas.
No, you didn't. I'm just saying is, like, he constructed a reality that was then accepted. We can all individually do that now.
Right. But challenge, right? Like, by 1550, the Spanish are having a debate about whether the conquest is just. They actually bring together scholars to say, is this just or is this not just? Like, there is a whole long tradition of disputation about that. So I guess I do think there is something different about this moment, which is, There's endless political chicanery and lying and skullduggery and shenanigans in American politics. And you can point to stories of this, you know, outrageous travesty conducted at this presidential nominating convention in 1860. Or, you know, you can come up with all kinds of lists of things. Oh, it's not as bad as that. Or it's always been like this. And I think what's different now is the degree to which the system that we have in place with regard to how people gather information, to the degree that we as citizens gather information and make informed decisions, we have no control. We have almost no control over it. So the partisan polarization that we experience was built manually by political consultants in the 1970s and 1980s who wanted to get voters to vote, you know, just in 2 weeks away. And they used guns and abortion as the kind of go-to easy emotional issues to alarm their constituencies and get people to vote for short-term partisan goals. They built that system of partisanship. But in the beginning of the 21st century, that system became automated, kind of unintentionally. Those political consultants didn't actually do that. That happened because we failed to regulate or think about the internet as a public utility. And now we're all trapped in that machine, and it's terrible. And I think people would like to get out of it, but it's automated.
Yeah. Jill Lepore, in the close of your book, you This is a little paragraph that I want to read, if I could. You write, "A nation born in revolution will forever struggle against chaos. A nation founded on universal rights will wrestle against the forces of particularism. A nation that toppled a hierarchy of birth only to erect a hierarchy of wealth will never know tranquility. A nation of immigrants cannot close its borders, and a nation born in contradiction, liberty in a land of slavery, sovereignty in a land of conquest, will fight forever over the meaning of its history." So I guess I wonder, you know, again, the ghost of Alexander Hamilton is lurking throughout this conversation. Was the dichotomy of, you know, that question that he asked at the beginning of the choice that Americans had to make, did he actually get the dichotomy wrong? That it wasn't really we didn't really face a choice between, you know, reason and enlightenment system of government, you know, founded by self-evident truth versus chaos, but rather like the question is, does this new system of government, does this new nation have the strength to withstand the chaos that's built into its DNA? Should that have been the question?
Yeah, I think he asked the right question. It's just that the set of arrangements has changed so dramatically and we haven't kept track of that. So we live in, which is so trapped in this prison of the present and this automated polarization machine, that I think it's very difficult to do the work that is actually required of being a citizen in a democracy. I mean, the country's founded on equality, but it's founded on inquiry. And that's what Hamilton is insisting on. In order for this to work, you have to be constantly making a study of whether this is a just way to do things. And that's right. Your obligation. It's hard to do. And we need to, I think clearly about how necessary it is.
Well, you call on a new generation of Americans to do exactly that. I mean, is that you call them to learn an ancient art? And is that the art of inquiry and examination that you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it's to sort of throw off to abandon the easy path of just agreeing with what's being sent to you and to do some investigation. And I think the study of history, in fact, does matter. And we can't stem our ways out of this problem.
I can't tell if you're optimistic or not about America's future. I really can't.
Yeah. So I tell the story in the book about how Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote this beautiful poem about a ship called the Union, and he showed it to his friend Charles Sumner, and this is before the Civil War. And in the end of the poem, the ship gets dashed against the rocks in a hurricane and is destroyed. And Charles Sumner says, "Look, Henry, you're like America's best beloved poet. You can't have our whole country just destroyed in your poem. You have to write a better ending. We needed some hope." You know, the sort of this is what's called for now, actually, is asking people to think about where hope lies. And so I took that to heart when I got to the end of the book, because I wasn't especially feeling optimistic. But we do need to think about where hope lies.
Well, Jill Lepore, she's professor of American history at Harvard University, staff writer for The New Yorker, and author of the new book, These Truths: A History of the United States. Professor Lepore, I want to tell you, this book is going to be on my nightstand for a long time. I'm going to keep coming back to it again and again. It's an absolutely terrific read. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much.
And folks, let us know what you think about America's self-evident truths and whether or not we're living up to them. Go to onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.